Hello, welcome to SportsInvasion.net's One-on-One. I'm Jason Tabris. In professional football, if you want to get lost, punished, bloodied, and bruised, there's no place to play like the offensive line. For years in San Francisco, at the height of one of the most impressive dynasties in NFL history, Jesse Sapolo stood at the center of it all, handing the ball to Joe Montana and then Steve Young as they led the team to four Super Bowl championships from 1984 to 1994. Through it all, though, Sapolo, an 11th-round pick, kept hidden a medical secret that put his well-being in jeopardy. That secret, a heart condition, is revealed and explored in Sapolo's new book, I Gave My Heart to San Francisco. And in this exclusive interview, I talked to Jesse about playing through pain and risk, head injuries, how Joe Montana and Steve Young would fare in today's game, and whether Alex Smith can lead today's 49ers to a Super Bowl. Here now is Jesse Sapolo in his own words.
In your book, I Gave My Heart to San Francisco, you talk about playing through a torn aortic valve. There were times when you were barely able to breathe. Knowing what you know now, and you've seen some players pass, Corey Stringer and Thomas Herrien, who died because of a heart condition, do you ever think that could have been me? And when you were playing, Reggie Lewis, the Celtics guard, he passed.
Right.
Did that kind of put a shock into you?
Yeah, I mean, knowing that I know now, Jason, it was, now I know how dangerous it really was. Hank Gathers out of Loyola Marymount, but, you know, at the time that I played, there was not a lot of examples of things happening that would have scared me to the point where I would have to ask myself. I think the experience and the hurt that I experienced as a young child, being a big kid for my age and not being able to play where other kids were playing, just kind of conditioned my mind to go around what the doctors were saying and just trying to get on the, you know, I was just trying to get on the field to play, to have fun as a kid and not necessarily worry about the consequences. But knowing what I know now, even my son Roman had a teammate in a kid named Fred Thompson that died of an irregular heartbeat just playing basketball before he went home. And I look back on it now, and it's crazy. But at the time, I didn't really know any better, to be honest with you.
Do you think players, and this is not just with relation to what you went through, but also a big topic now is head injuries. Do you think a lot of players kind of feel like they're bulletproof or they're invulnerable? And if you do, why do you think that attitude exists?
You know, you're conditioned to overcome adversity as a player. You know, there's a difference between being hurt and being injured. I know my longtime offensive line coach Bob McKitchick would say that, you know, the doctors will tell you that you can't play, but a warrior's heart and a warrior's mentality is you make the call if you want to play or not. What he really meant is you dictate if you're going to play regardless of what the doctors say, and that was the mentality back when I played with the Niners. You know, now we got so much study done and so much information on concussions. You know, Jason, I had four or five headaches in my career. I don't know if that was concussions because we didn't know the details. You know, now it probably would be considered, mild concussions, but back then we always referred to it as a headache, and once that headache disappears, it's time for you to step back on the field.
Do you think that's a dangerous way to go about things, though, to let players kind of dictate when they've had enough? I mean, I mean, to a degree, it's necessary, I suppose. But I mean, I've heard stories, countless stories of players who've lied just to get back on the field. They've, you know, I'd heard it was on the Dan Patrick show. I think he was talking about one player. I don't remember the player, but he would grab his ankle if he went out with a head injury just so he could get back in the game because he knew they would look at the ankle then. Do you think it's dangerous to trust that players are going to make those conscious decisions and actually weigh those actions at that moment and how they can have an effect?
Well, what we know now is dangerous, but the culture, when I played, that was just the mentality. You know, that was what was instilled to us, even from you know, high school and college, you know, it becomes part of who you are. And when you don't have the medical field and the medical study to back up anything, you know, it's pretty much, you know, you have to tough it out, and that's what was acceptable back then. Now with, you know, I saw a study the other day and about people who want to make helmets that collect data as far as they would know when you're getting close to having a concussion. And, you know, I remember, you know, Heinz Ward made a great comment that says, you know, the players were never accepted because, you know, if it's a key moment of a game and you're feeling okay, but your helmet says that you're getting close to having a concussion, how are you going to accept the fact that someone takes you out of a game in a key moment of a game when you physically feel okay, but the data says otherwise? So, you know, times are different now. Back then, that's what, you know, I conditioned my mind and my generation, we conditioned our mind to overcome, and it was normal, you know. But you're right, you know, is it crazy now? Yeah, probably is, but that's what it was back in the 80s and 90s.
Does the NFLPA do enough for retired players to help them kind of transition to make sure to check on them, make sure that their health and their well-being is taken care of? I know we've heard, you know, we've heard some horror stories, obviously, through the years. Guys right. like Mike Webster, for one, is one that definitely rings a bell. Do you think that they're doing enough?
Well, they're doing much better, but not nearly enough. There's just no way that you can work at this type of occupation and have the problems physically and emotionally and that a lot of the players go through. You know, compared to other fields who, you know, have much better insurance, medical insurance and the help that they and the benefits that they get compared to what we get as former players, there's just no way. It's not enough. But I just appreciate the effort that they're making to improve it. But as of right now, it's not nearly enough.
Do you think that today's players don't appreciate the past enough? What you know, the hardships that former players have gone through to kind of advance the game? Obviously, you know, players today are making a heck of a lot more money than you guys were, and you know that's because of the sacrifice that you guys have made. Do you think there's a respect gap there?
Yeah, there is, but human nature is you don't think of those whose shoulders you stood on until you're done. You know, Jason, when I played, you know, I played long enough to where I kind of leaked into some decent money. You know, but there were people before us that were complaining about the money we made. And a lot of the players, the majority of the players, don't think about those things until they get into that situation. So, you know, the thing about players that play today is if they invest their money right, they're going to be set for life. But so it's easy for them to forget the guys that, you know, I struck twice in my career. You know, when those are the kind of things that we fought for. But, you know, there's a few players that have donated money to improve situations of retired players. But for the most part, they don't appreciate it until probably how they feel physically when they leave the game and they realize that, you know, not enough has been done.
Can you describe the transition that you went through from being an active player to where you are today, and what did you experience? Any hardships? Did you have to deal with any depression or withdrawal? And what's helped you to get from there to here?
Well, yeah, there's no question that you know, about 4 months ago or 3.5 months ago, I was at I went to my friend Junior Seau's funeral, and it's amazing. You know, Junior's always been a happy-go-lucky, but that's a big cover-up. You know, what you see on the outside is not necessarily what you see on the inside, and it gives you an idea of what we go through. And I went through some depression, you know, especially the first year I was out, the first 2 years I was out. Because, Jason, you know, even the problem is even your own immediate family. And I had a solid foundation, a solid family support system, but they still didn't understand the significance of what you go through, because the only people that understands are other players that actually go through the same similar experience. Because when we announce our retirement, I played 15 years in the NFL, but when you announce your retirement, people think, wow, that, you know, I can't believe those guys are crying when they announce. Well, you know, for me, it's just not the 15 years that I played in the NFL. It's something that I did since I was 8 years old. I was 10 years old. To us, yeah, we got paid later on for what we did, but it's the only thing that we know. So the impact, it gives you an idea of the impact emotionally that you know, goes on in our minds. And for all those years, all you hear is the coach saying, you know, you got to run through that wall, you got to overcome, you got to be the tough warrior, you got to, you know, it's always the pedal to the metal. And then all of a sudden, in a matter of a few months, they tell you, that's it, turn the engine off. And that's something that a lot of the players, and I would say close to 100% of the guys that play long enough, you know, really have to deal with. And then, of course, missing the adrenaline of playing in front of thousands of fans and then millions on TV, all the other stuff comes to it. And then the feeling of you're not worth as much, you know, because you're not quite as popular as during your playing days, you know. Those are the mental, emotional things that a lot of the retired players go through, that it's not supported enough when they retire from the NFL.
When did you know it was time to hang them up, to retire?
Well, nobody nobody will ever admit to himself and ride out on their white horse and say it's time. But, you know, I played long enough to the point where I kind of knew it was time, like the year before or 2 years before. But, you know, I was released as a victim after a victim of the salary cap. You know, we started having a salary cap. And, you know, when you get up to year 13 and 14, they started thinking if you're worth the salary cap, you know, and taking your age into account. So I became a victim of that. And then having open heart surgery and come back and playing with it, you know, they take that into account, you know, because that's something that's never been done before. How dangerous is it? You know, is the club safe to let him keep playing and all that kind of stuff?
Let me transition to the game itself. You played with, and you are a legend, but you played with some legends, you know, Joe Montana, Steve Young, among two of them, Jerry Rice, obviously, Roger Craig, John Taylor, nobody gives enough credit to, I think. What were the differences between Montana and Young as teammates and as leaders on the field? And also, do you think that maybe quarterbacks have a little too easy right now? Maybe those guys don't get enough credit for what they did. Because I sure do.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Jason, I talk a lot about the difference between the two in the book.
Okay.
You know, but you're right. I mean, the protection that the quarterbacks have today, you know, with you know, you can't crawl, you can't fall as a defensive end trying to get there and then crawl into making the tackle, because that's dangerous for them. The other thing is, last year, if you look at how many guys, you know, broke, there were a couple quarterbacks that broke Dan Marino's.
Drew Brees threw for what?
Right, Drew Brees, and then I think
yards,
someone else was real close to it. I think Brady was close to it.
I think it's Matt Ryan with Atlanta. Or
right,
maybe Stafford.
You know, but it gives you an idea that today they've done everything in their power to take the physicality of the defense away. especially the bump and run technique, how you can be physical in the line of scrimmage and all that. And it's allowed for these quarterbacks to put up the numbers because, you know, the NFL want excitement. They want to spread the field out and they want to air it out, you know. I guess in their minds, it adds to the popularity of the game. So
let me ask you, who do you think would fare better in today's game, Steve or Montana? Because they were different styles. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, there were different styles. But as you know, you tell me one running quarterback that has won a Super Bowl consistently today. Last year was Eli Manning. The year before it was Aaron Rodgers. They're not running quarterbacks. You know, everybody buys into the excitement of Michael Vick's abilities and, you know, a lot of these, you know, Cam Newton's got the ability to run. But look at the best rookie quarterback this past week. It was a guy that runs a 4.3, but did he run? No, he didn't. He stayed in the pocket and had the best game to me, the best game ever for a rookie starter in his first game, even more than Cam Newton did last year because he didn't throw any interceptions, and it was the best game I've seen a rookie play. And here's a guy that probably runs as fast as Michael Vick, but different style. He stayed in the pocket. They rolled him out a few times, but those were designed for him to throw the ball, and he did that. I think one of the plays, he had an opportunity to run for a 12- to 15-yard gain, and he stood there and you know, changed his mind and threw the ball for a 25-yard gain. So, to me, you know, people can say, well, this is the age of the running quarterback. Really? Who? Name one running quarterback that has won the Super Bowl consistently, you know, since I've retired.
And even going back to Cunningham. Because, I mean, right, he was, right. I mean, of all the quarterbacks, I've seen, I mean, just a physical
right.
marvel.
And Cunningham was exciting. You remember yeah. when he first came out? He was exciting. But did he win anything? Absolutely not. You know, so the game, you know, it's funny. You know, when you hear people, oh, they're bigger and stronger and faster now. And I'm like, okay, yeah, there's a lot more bigger. There's a lot more Bubba Parris type guys. No question, you know, because back then Bubba was like, you know, 340, 6'6". And Bill Walsh thought, you know, that, you know, because he had a little excess weight that slowed him down. But there's a lot more of those guys now, you know. But none of these guys can run as fast as McIntyre and I ever did.
Hey, some of those guys could run, man. Mm-hmm. I remember, I don't remember who you guys are playing. I just remember it was a fumble recovery. Michael Carter picked it up, ran it all the way back, and I swear it looked like it was slow motion the entire time. But damned if he didn't make it all the way.
It was a Redskins.
Was it the Skins? I thought it was the Skins. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't remember what year that was, but just that was like slow motion in real time. It was sight to see. I'll never forget watching Joe play his last game. As a Niner against the Lions, 92 on Monday Night Football. Did you guys have a sense that that was the last time that you were going to see him playing with the 49ers?
I knew it was possible. If you remember, Joe was out the whole year, and just to see him in the huddle, just, you know, made your blood, you know, it's like made your body feel like, you know, it brings back all the great memories of what you've been through together. You know, with that drive in Super Bowl 23 to the domination in Super Bowl 24, you know, just to see him back in there, it was great because he was out for a while, you know.
Was
and,
it Steve's team at that point?
What? No, I don't think so. I don't think it was Steve's team at that point because if you remember Steve's first year starting, we struggled. You know, our offense still had good stats, but we remember when we went to the Raiders and Steve threw a high pass that kind of Jerry Rice reached for, and he was undercut, and Jerry landed on his neck in L.A., and to see Jerry sprawled on the field like that, that was something new to us. And then we drove the ball all the way down to the 6-yard line, and we stalled for all four downs there. And the Raiders beat us in a close game in L.A. But so for us, it was like, you know, if number 16 was driving the bus, there's no doubt in our minds that we would have won that game. But those are some of the, you know, I talk about that game in the book also. But, no, it wasn't quite Steve's team at that point. I think it became Steve's team when Joe or Eddie wanted Joe to come back. You remember they were thinking of, I think it was a trade. And then I think the fans were very happy, and Eddie stepped in and wanted Joe to come back. This is how it went. Joe just wanted an opportunity to come to training camp and compete with Steve. But I think it was George said that, you know, Steve was going to be the first team quarterback, even if Joe came back. So Joe asked for a trade, and then Eddie stepped in and said that he would let Joe compete for the job, but Joe didn't want to make any waves and talk to Eddie about letting him go to Kansas City. That's how it happened. But there was no question that, to me, you know, because that year, you know, Steve Bono came out of nowhere and we won like 5 or 6 in a row. And I felt like because Steve Bono had proven himself, that if we would have taken a chance on Joe physically, you know, we had someone that has proven himself to back him up. But that means we would have had to let Steve go, which was a young, physically gifted quarterback. So those are a lot of the things that was going on at the time.
Yeah, people don't remember Steve Bono was a really solid quarterback, and he got a chance to start with the Chiefs after Montana left.
Well, he got the big contract because of that 6-game stretch, you know, that we won all those years. And if you look at it, also, when Steve got hurt, after we won the Super Bowl 29, and we went to Dallas with Elvis Gerback, remember that? And we soundly beat Dallas.
Elvis was a solid quarterback. You guys were a factory for a while there.
Right. He was a solid quarterback. He won 5-6 games in a row, and he got a big quarterback, I mean, a big contract. And I think he went to the Chiefs also, I think.
Yeah, went to the Chiefs, and then he went to the Ravens after that.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
and then he retired young. I think he was like 32.
Right. So a lot of those guys got good contracts somewhere else. They weren't quite effective over there, but they all got their great start with the Niners. Yeah.
Do you your guys, you and Steve Wallace, Harris Barton, Guy mm-hmm. McIntyre, do you think you guys got enough credit for the success of those teams, like the you know, like the Hogs did, you know, Russ Grimm and right. You know, Letter Schlereth and all those guys with the Redskins?
No. No, and that is because of perception. A lot of it is because we had a lot of superstars on our team, and you know the offensive line is the last position to give credit to. But you know, I think we got credit later on in our careers when they call us one of the best lines in the NFL. But you know, they didn't appreciate athleticism. To get out there in the open field constantly and lead Roger Craig on those sweeps and things like that. But I don't think we did. But, you know, that's when you win, who cares, you know?
Well, true, yeah.
To me personally, you know, I played the game to win, and everything else, if whatever extra, you know, recognition comes my way, then I'll take it. But you know, I'm not gonna go shoot for individual awards and play on the losing team. You know, we've known some players that when the Pro Bowl voting comes off, you know, that's all they're concerned about. There's some teams that never made the playoffs, and we really never wanted to be that. You know, I think Eddie DiBartolo set a standard for us to shoot for. And Bill Walsh was one of the most demanding coaches I ever played for. And the number one thing that we wanted to do was to consistently shoot to win the Super Bowl. And I think we did that for the most part.
Speaking of the culture, and from your and you work with the team, how has the culture changed since Trent Baalke and Coach Harbaugh took over?
Well, you know,
because obviously we see the on-field product has changed dramatically. But, like, from just the inside out, I mean, obviously things have got to be run a little bit differently now.
Well, you know, the thing that's great about it, Jason, is that, you know, Jed York was a young man that walked around our sidelines and every now and then would come with his uncle, Eddie, to the sideline before the games and you know, socialize with some of the players. So Jed understands what the 49ers standard is. In fact, I spoke to him in training camp this year when I was up there for about 4 or 5 days. And first, we, you know, it's funny, we talk about, I said, Jed, man, this is nice. They get to stay at the Marriott for training camp, and they come here and practice in Santa Clara. And Jed said, well, you know, Jeff, you know, I know back in the day we would take you guys to Rockland for in 105-degree heat, you know, in the hopes to toughen the team up so that we can overcome anything. But there's no study that's been done that's proven that scientifically. And I joked back to him. I said, well, why didn't you find this guy back then? So we were joking about that. But then he said something to me. He says, you know, Jeff, you know, because I told him, man, it was so nice to see the fans excited and see that stadium excited again, especially against New Orleans and the Giants, even though we lost. And Jed said something to me that resonated with me. He says, Jeff, I hope these guys realize that this organization is just not about winning divisions. And that's how I know in my heart that this kid has it, you know, because he's seen it and he's been around it. And, you know, and you look at the things that he's done to go after Harbaugh, which I write about in a book, you know, as a former Stanford coach and things. And then Trent Baalke is a young, up-and-coming general manager. You know, they're not going to do it exactly the way we did it, and they shouldn't, because times have changed. But I think the standard is the same. And as long as that the standard is the same and we shoot for, you know, it's either Super Bowl or bust, then I think we're going to be fine. And with the new stadium coming up, you know, well, we might be looking at some Super Bowls down the line.
Is Alex Smith the guy who's going to bring him to the promised
well,
land? Is he Super Bowl quarterback?
You know, he looked good on Sunday.
Damn good on Sunday. And honestly, he looked, you know, he looked like a winner in the playoffs. You can say what you will. You know?
Right, and considering where he came from before last year. You know, considering where
he
came from.
Five coaches,
before
five
last
coordinators
year.
In as many years, I believe,
right?
Or at least five
but
coordinators.
But I think, Jason, the fact that coordinators, you know, doesn't make the final decision. Coordinators doesn't motivate you. And a lot of those coordinators never really played at the level that Coach Jim Harbaugh played at. The fact that he has a head coach that played the position, and he has a head coach that just pumps confidence into him, it's a big difference. You know, it's a big, big difference. Knowing that it's your head man that is telling you how good you can be and how good you're going to be, I think it's the biggest thing that's ever happened to Alex last year. Now, did he perform like a Tom Brady? And of course not. Like a Drew Brees? Of course not. But the progress, if he keeps making that progress, and I saw some of that progress on Sunday, and part of that is Harbaugh went out and got some weapons for him on top of just Vernon Davis. You know, when Vernon Davis was our deep threat last year, what does that tell you? You know, but now we got Randy Moss, we got Manningham, and Crabtree's a year older and he's healthier. You know, it's exciting times for us. And I'm not going to get overly excited, but I know in my heart that Alex, if he keeps making progress, will be good enough for us to win the Super Bowl.
Once again, that was Jesse Sapolo, former All-Pro center for the San Francisco 49ers. If you want to hear more about Jesse's career and also his thoughts on the current team in San Francisco, pick up his book, I Gave My Heart to San Francisco, which is available on many fine internet retailers. Now I want to say thank you again for listening to One-on-One here on SportsInvasion.net. I'm Jason Tabris. Goodbye.